Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Dan Thomas. Joining the studio throughout today via Shaka Hislop. And what a show we have for you. Jürgen Klinsmann will be joining us a little later on to pay tribute to Inter Milan winning the championship in Italy. Ali here as well to look back on a big result for Barcelona against Valencia. But we start in England and those scenes at Old Trafford. Manchester United, of course, were due to play Liverpool today. That game postponed after protests outside the stadium spilled to the pitch at Old Trafford. As we welcome in Mark Ogden, Nana Manua and Gab Marcotti. Mark, I want to start with you. Were you outside Old Trafford? Just talk us through your experience.
Yeah, even before I arrived at the stadium today, Dan, it was obvious there was going to be trouble. That we'd heard reports that a lot of fans had gathered outside the Man United team hotel, which is about 2 miles from Old Trafford. The coaches couldn't leave the hotel. And by the time I got to Old Trafford, maybe 2.5, 3 hours before kickoff, which is really early at the moment in terms of the COVID protocols, all the gates were locked. I was told you couldn't get in. Lockdown of the stadium had happened, so we had to park outside for maybe an hour. And then more fans arrived. And then on the other side of the stadium, the fans had got in from the front end of the stadium where they run onto the pitch. They started to climb on the goalpost, went up the tunnel, into dressing rooms, offices. You know, United staff had to hide in their offices, lock themselves in rooms. It was chaotic. And as we know, the scenes were so bad that they basically breached the COVID protocols. That the red zone in Old Trafford is where only kind of it's a biosecure environment where players and staff can go, and the fans have been in the dressing rooms, they've been in the tunnel, so that meant that it was no longer secure. So eventually the game had to be called off because, first of all, it wasn't COVID safe, and secondly, nobody knew if there were any fans still in the stadium who were, you know, planning to disrupt the game once it was started. So a bad day all round for people at United and the Premier League.
Mark, how much were the fact that they breached the Old Trafford security, got themselves on the pitch, how much was that premeditated, or how much was that just a spontaneous act?
Well, I think people have known this has been planned for a while, that certainly the protests have been planned. It's been well publicised all week, and I've heard reports, unconfirmed reports, that one of the gates at Old Trafford wasn't locked as it might have been, and that fans were allowed to get in. So if that's the case, or whether they forced it down, whichever way, they shouldn't have been in there. I mean, people that go to Old Trafford will tell you it's the hardest stadium in England to get in. Even in normal times, there's all sorts of checks. There's, you know, the security checks way before you even get to the stadium. So for fans to get in the stadium, it reflects really badly on people who are charged keeping them out. So you have to wonder how it happened. And we've seen the scenes on the pitch. That is just, you know, it's unprecedented for this to happen in a Premier League stadium of the magnitude of Old Trafford. For fans to get in, not only to run around and cause chaos, but to film themselves climbing the post, scoring goals, doing all sorts of things. It was just crazy. And you know, the fact that the biggest game in English football tradition has been called off by fans is a huge, huge thing.
Mark, it seemed to be more chaotic than any sort of violent edge to it going into the actual stadium.
Yeah, I mean, you see the pitch in the stadium, it looks like a bunch of guys playing around and having fun, but the reality is that the Greater Manchester Police have released a statement tonight talking about how one of their officers has had to have emergency surgery, having had his face slashed by a bottle that was thrown. So it did turn ugly and it was violent, and I think, you know, thankfully it wasn't worse, but this is the situation we're in, that people have been hurt, and you know, they may have been looking like they were having fun on the pitch, but outside the stadium trouble happened, and you know, a police officer is undergoing emergency surgery because of it.
So where do we stand with regards to the empathy that people seem to be having towards the fans, Mark?
Well, I think certainly from the European Super League situation, the fans created a lot of goodwill with the way that they protested. They came together peacefully, I think. There were obviously situations at Arsenal where it got quite boisterous, but we didn't see it turn into violence. And I think this is the situation now whereby this seemed to cross the line in the sense that it wasn't a peaceful protest, that trouble happened. And I'm not sure that the United fans will have that kind of public support now because of what happened here. It seemed to cross the line from a peaceful protest to... I think as well, this was more specifically aimed at the ownership of Man United. It wasn't about the European Super League. The European Super League was maybe the trigger for, you know, a long-held grudge against the Glazers to come back into the open again. But it's hard to say you're going to get public support when this sort of thing happens, where you're breaking into a stadium, the property was taken, corner flags were taken, match balls were taken, police officers hurt. It's hard to kind of gain the public sympathy when that happens.
Mark, we've seen protests before, obviously, against the Glazers. Will this have any sort of different effect?
I don't think it will. You know, I think obviously the Glazers will be aware of what's happened. I'm assuming they're still in the US, they're in Florida, they're in New York where they have homes, and I think they'll see it, they'll be disappointed about it, and they'll think that it's not great, it doesn't reflect well on them or the club, but I don't think it'll change the ownership. The club is worth, I think, £3 billion, maybe $4 billion on the stock exchange. Who can buy that? The fans can't afford to buy it. The fans can't buy the owners out. And while the owners are, while the Glazers are making money out of the club, you know, every year they can take 70, 80 million out of the club, they're not going to sell. It's making money for them. It's a profitable enterprise. And, you know, the issues they've had with the fans, they've had them before, not to the extent where they've had fans invading the pitch, but, you know, the Green and Gold campaign, which happened, I think, 2010, that was a prolonged campaign against the owners, and they rolled that out, and I think they'll ride this one out. I think the season's due to end in maybe 2 or 3 weeks. They'll hope that the summer comes along, they'll sign a couple of players, quell the majority of unrest, and there'll always be a minority of fans who are completely against the Glazers all the time. But if you can get the majority of those fans happily to turn up at Old Trafford, as they do, I think that the Glazers will ride it out, because the Man United is worth too much for them to let it go.
Nader, Manchester, of course, your home. What did you make of the scenes today?
As Mark was saying there, it's very much unprecedented. And speaking to some of my United friends, I asked them the question, did you want to be there and be part of that protest? And most of them were saying, well, no, not really. And I think for as much as, you know, we can talk about, will they get public sympathy? I think they believe this is an issue for themselves. But whether or not this causes a civil war amongst, say, United fans, in terms of the ones who think that's the right thing to do and those who don't, you know, we'll have to see in time. But it was crazy to see. And for the Premier League itself, as Mark said, that is, you could argue that is the biggest game in the Premier League every single season. And for it to not go ahead because of the protest, and don't get me wrong, I'm pro-protesting. But I think for what happened today, it's the type of thing which you hope you'll never see again. But the point of the protest has happened, and I think their voices will be heard because people can't escape it. I think if they're outside the stadium, it could maybe go away. But the fact the game's been cancelled because of it, I think it's huge news. And ultimately, I think the fallout from it is going to be very, very interesting going forward. Because as I say, I don't know what the consensus is amongst Manchester United fans, whether they're happy with this or they're embarrassed. And if they're embarrassed, I think they're going to speak up.
What could the fallout be, Gab?
Well, it's interesting, right? We're all sitting here judging what will the mood be, what the zeitgeist is. There was a statement recently from the mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, who, you know, obviously that's his police out there, you know, and he obviously condemned the violence and the trespassing. But he also says the focus has to be on the people at the top of the game. The focus has to remain on owners like the Glazer. I think there's the conversation, I think, has reached a point where our attitudes towards direct action, peaceful protests, you know, go to the Lowry, 200 fans outside stopping the bus from leaving. I think people are a little more tolerant and more open to direct action, also because of what went on last summer, you know, in the U.S. and elsewhere over obviously much different issues. But there is a real sense, a real impetus that, you know, the time for something to change in terms of regulation and whatnot is now. Because, you know, you don't have to be a United fan to look at, and I'm talking specifically about the Glazers, but as well, the Super League. You don't have to be a United fan to realize that what they did and what they have done is wrong from the perspective of sport, as most people understand it, where you load up, you borrow a bunch of money to buy a club, then you put that debt onto the club, so you're home free. The club, which hadn't had debt since 1931, you take out, as Mark told us, 70, 80 million out of the club every year, part of it going to service that debt, which you put on to buy the club, part of it in dividends and fees to you. And then on top of that, add insult to injury, you're talking about a club that since 2013, all they've won is a Europa League and an FA Cup. And they might win another Europa League this year. Woohoo. So obviously this one's counter to, I think, people's accepted wisdom of football. People are okay with owners making money off a club if the club is successful, if money gets reinvested in the club, and then it appreciates in value, and then you sell it, and you've made yourself a bundle. People are fine with that. But these circumstances, I think people feel that they're taken for a ride. And it is shades of 2010 and the green and gold, but I think the general mood is different. And there's no Sir Alex Ferguson there either to kind of, you know, nobody wants to go and ruin his final years of the club. Fine. But he's not there. So I think the mood, from what I can tell from here, is a bit different.
What happens next, Mark?
Well, first of all, we have to find out when this game is going to get played, because it's, you know, I've only got 2 or 3 weeks left of the season, so that is a big game to play. There's not a lot of gap in the calendar to have it. But in terms of the bigger picture with the Glazers, you know, I just don't see them moving. And I think the problem with the Glazers is that when they bought the club in 2005, they probably felt that they could run out this business plan and get away with it, because they had Sir Alex Ferguson in charge, and they kept winning for a while. But what's happened at Man City has completely changed the game. 2008 comes along, Sheikh Mansour comes in, and while the Glazers have taken out over £1 billion in terms of debt payments, dividends, Sheikh Mansour's put £1 billion in, and more. So the Man United fans, not only are they angry with their own owners for doing what they've done and turning a once, you know, freestanding, profitable club into a debt-laden club, they've got their big rivals across the city who, prior to 2008, were derided as a joke club by Man United, who have now become the most successful club in England. Their owner puts money in, they buy the best players, they improve the stadium. Everything that Man United fans want their club to be, and that the club can afford to be because the club generates enough money of its own, isn't happening because the owners are taking money out. So, you know, I was at a game at Old Trafford 2 years ago, City in the Derby game, and I think City won to basically win the league. And it was raining outside, and the roof was leaking at Old Trafford. And that was a metaphor for how the Glazers have run Man United. The roof was leaking at Old Trafford as we were playing Man City, as Man City went to win another league title. And it's because the Glazers are taking money out and not putting it in, at the same time as Sheikh Mansour is putting lots of money in. You know, people might question the motives of Abu Dhabi and Sheikh Mansour, and it's a valid question to ask. But in terms of the football side of it, the Glazers are taking money out, Sheikh Mansour's putting money in, and the Man United fans are sick of it. And that is the issue. They're absolutely sick of the way their club is being run. It's a hugely profitable club, makes lots of money, but the club is still failing because the money has either been misinvested or mismanaged. And the Glazers have just turned English football's biggest and most successful club into a club that doesn't win anything anymore.
Julian Aron was at Old Trafford. He's just arrived at his home studio. Jules, how would you sum up your day?
It was a crazy day, Dan. Something like I've never seen before. I mean, I knew there was going to be a protest because we were told that we would not be able to film for French television, we've got the rights for the Premier League in France, where the protest was in front of the shop, in front of the main entrance of the stadium. But I never thought that he would get to the point that he got, to the point that at some point we were told, stay in your car and don't move because they are raiding the stadium, they're raiding the pitch, they might come for you, they might come for journalists, they might come for people who work at the club. And then we saw them running out of the stadium, literally through the Munich tunnel and then through the back exit, really, where the teams are coming in and where Mark with his car and me with my car, we were coming in today. I arrived a bit before Mark because I had to be there early for a few live hits. It was just unreal. And then I had a feeling from very early on that this game was not going to be played at all. And we were aware of what was happening at the Lorry Hotel and where the Liverpool players were. And then we saw the Liverpool press officers coming in. They had no idea. The people from the Premier League production had no idea. Even from the Premier League on site had no much idea of what was happening, really. And it was just incredible scenes. And I can understand the need for protesting, but this was something like really I'd never seen ever before. And clearly the aim was for that game not to be played. And in a way, they succeeded.
Jules, how will this be received? Obviously, you cover the Premier League for France. Internationally, will this be perceived as England going back to its old hooligan ways? Or will the point that they're trying to make actually come across?
I don't think it would be seen as the hooligans are back in, because it was a peaceful for most of it, really. For 95 or maybe 98% of it was a peaceful protest. I mean, certainly I know there's been a bit of trouble with the police outside, so maybe 90% of it. But from the bit I saw and from what I heard and the people we talked to at the ground, it was peaceful. It was just a protest against the Glazers family and try to make their voice heard. And they've had enough. They've had enough for all what Gab and Mark just explained very, very rightly of the way the club has been going downhill since they took over, certainly, and since Sir Alex Ferguson retired, really. And I think that, in a way, that people in France understood that, they believed it. What they struggled to understand is how you can go and in a way damage your club and the image of your club worldwide by preventing your own players from getting to their own stadium to play what is the biggest game in English football history, and a game that could have prevented your neighbours, your own neighbours, just for a week, but it's still a week, from being crowned champions in a way. And that's what people in France really struggle to understand, is why would you do that to your own players, not your owners, but at least your own players. And in a way, I understand that as well, and it's something that, and as you know, in France we love a protest and we love a march, but this one, I think, for a lot of the French football fans was a bit hard to understand.
Nadim?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think one key difference between this and, say, the stuff which came in relation to the Super League week is now, what do the players say? What do the coaches say? Because I think last week or whenever it was, everybody came together to say they didn't like the idea. But now you're coming and you're protesting and stuff like this, and players were looking forward to that game. You know, the whole footballing world was looking forward to that game. For the players, did it say, yeah, the fans were right? And in which case, you undermine the people that brought you to the club, the people that pay your wages, or do you say nothing? Because if you say nothing, do the supporters now think that they've been left alone to basically just protest by themselves? You know, it's going to be a really, really tough time for United between now and the end of the season. And ultimately, the thing that I think is the most sad for United right now is that I would argue in the last few years, this is probably the best that I've seen them. They've unbeaten away from home the whole season. Obviously, the Europa League isn't the Champions League like they want, but they look far and away the best team left in the competition. It feels like they may be one signing away from being really significant in the Premier League again next season. So things are looking up. But now, as I say, it seems like there's probably going to be a divide, because those players, between now and the end of the year, they're not going to be able to avoid having to answer questions about what they thought about the fans there. And if that causes a rift, then, you know, it's going to be a really tough club to play for in the coming weeks.
It's a really good point, Mark, isn't it? And you've got quite a few contacts, obviously, within Manchester United. How will they react to this?
Well, I think they'll be confused and they'll be wondering what's happening, because, you know, Nadim has a better sense of it than me, but they'll be sat in the hotel for 2-3 hours wondering what's going to happen next. And what, and I'm sure some will have sympathy with the supporters, because, you know, they can see where the fans are coming from, in the sense that the players want better players on the sand. The players want to challenge. Players who've been at Man United for quite a while will think that they should be better than they are. So I'd imagine the players privately are thinking, yes, we want this club to invest more, to punch its weight more against the wealthy clubs like Man City, but this isn't the way to do it, you know, the way it ended like this. And I think we have to find a way that the fans can have their voice heard without resorting to, you know, what we saw in the end with people being injured, you know. So for the players, they have to get back on the pitch and hope that next time they play, this doesn't happen again, because I think that'll be the concern there, that when they go to Aston Villa next Sunday, will it happen there? And will it spread? You know, there's a lot of clubs in English football who've got unpopular owners. What will Newcastle fans do now with Mike Ashley? Will Liverpool fans kind of renew their protest against FSG? Will the Arsenal fans take it another step level with Stan Kroenke? We saw it outside the Emirates last week that they're not happy at all. So does this give fans now the motivation to take it onto another level, or do we have to find a way to calm this down? But I just don't know who the voices are, because there's no leader in English football right now that will say, let's calm this down, let's get around the table, because I don't see any kind of room for compromise. The owners have no feeling for what the fans want. And, you know, I saw that the Glazer family apologised for the involvement in the Super League 2 weeks ago. That was the first communication to the United fans for 16 years. Wow. So are they going to open a communication line of communication now after this has happened? The last thing they want to do now is probably talk to people that have done this today. So I think we've got two camps of people that have got no common ground. So how do we solve this? It's going to be really tough to find a common ground and a resolution.
Thank you very much, guys. Of course, a lot more on what happened at Old Trafford on the latest edition of the Gab and Jules podcast, which drops on Monday. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. What a game in La Liga. Valencia taking on Barcelona. Valencia would take a 1-0 lead. Then Barca awarded a penalty. Messi would see it saved, but eventually it would be bundled home by the man himself. He'd score a great free kick as well, as Barcelona would go on to win this game by 3-2, keeping it extraordinarily tight at the top. Atleti 2 points clear then of Real Madrid and Barcelona, with Sevilla in action on Monday. Well, let's welcome in Ali Moreno to the show. Let's focus first, shall we, Ali, on that victory for Barcelona. Something has clearly changed. We've discussed this before, because a Barcelona side at the start of the season who went 1-0 down in the manner that they did would have folded. But we're seeing that character, haven't we? We've seen it build over recent months.
And we would have expected that character to come out in the last 20 minutes against Granada. And that's why it was so disappointing from Barcelona's perspective that you didn't see that in the midweek when you had a chance to get a hold of first place in La Liga. But we saw it today. And I just have to bring up a couple of names that usually I wouldn't bring up when I say Barcelona MVP. First one, Toni Lato, left back for Valencia, and his handball that gives an opportunity for Barcelona to get back into a match that they were having difficulties breaking down Valencia, and it was setting up for Valencia to go on the counter and exploit some of the frailties that Barcelona has defensively. The second one that I would mention is Sergio Busquets, who is the one that jumps on the rebound after Cillessen makes a save on the penalty kick by Lionel Messi. He keeps the ball alive, eventually falls to Messi, and then he scores. It's 1-1. Now the momentum was back with Barcelona. Imagine if this had been yet another penalty kick missed by Lionel Messi when you needed to get back into the match. If Sergio Busquets doesn't put that ball back into an area in which Messi can then jump on the rebound, then it's still 1-0, and then those shoulders and that mentality and that folding attitude that you're mentioning, I fear that may have crept into Barcelona. Instead, Sergio Busquets keeps it alive, then Lionel Messi scores a goal, Barcelona takes over, they win the game 3-2. It wasn't easy, it's not going to be easy, because as we know, for all three of these teams, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, and Barcelona, all of these games are going to be a heart attack.
It's going to be some weekend next weekend, Ali, isn't it? My crikey.
Well, yes, it is. And so the first priority for, say, Barcelona is, look, not only are we carrying some momentum going into that game, not only do we feel good about Atletico Madrid coming to the Camp Nou and us being able to control what we do and control our destiny, the other thing that they were able to do is they avoided yellow cards for players like Griezmann and Messi that could have been out. It had indeed they gotten a yellow card today. And so they didn't get a yellow today. They'll be available. So will Frenkie de Jong. And so it will be the best version of Barcelona welcoming Atletico Madrid. And while they hope that they can take care of Atletico Madrid, they're also paying attention to whatever Real Madrid and Sevilla are doing, because the importance of the result against Granada on Thursday, in which Barcelona were not able to even get a point from out of that match, is that now if Real Madrid run the table, even if Barcelona beat Atletico Madrid, Real Madrid holds the tiebreaker, and so therefore Real Madrid would be the champion. What you need if you're Barcelona, you need help from Sevilla. You need help in that somebody got to drop points there, and you hope that it is Real Madrid. You beat Atletico Madrid, and now you find a pathway back into the title. It's all sorts of complicated right now in La Liga.
Ali, at midweek, you accused Barcelona players of going missing, including Lionel Messi. That was some free kick today. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was. And I was afraid that I was going to have that same conversation with you today, Dan. Mm-hmm. And yet, that wasn't the case. Even in the disappointment of him missing the penalty and then getting and jumping on the rebound, scoring the goal, there was still a better attitude about Messi and Griezmann and Frenkie de Jong, who in particular was very good about timing his runs into the 18-yard box. And he created a problem for Valencia. And in that confusion is when Toni Lato commits a handball. It's when you see a little bit of confusion between the center backs, and eventually Lionel Messi is able to take advantage of some of the things that Valencia were not able to do defensively. As for the free kick, it's next level. It is Lionel Messi at his very best. And you're going to need that if you're a Barcelona. If you're a Barcelona fan right now, as much as you can talk about Griezmann and Pedri and De Jong and Dembele coming off the bench and Sergio Busquets and is Piqué going to be healthy, you can, and maybe Ter Stegen has to come up with a save. All those things are great, and you're going to need those things. But most of all, more importantly, you're going to need the very best, the absolute best from Lionel Messi if indeed you're going to be able to run the table. In order for this team to be perfect here on out, then Lionel Messi himself has to be close to perfect.
Who won the weekend, Ali?
La Liga. La Liga won the weekend because what you saw is that all the things that could have changed so dramatically in terms of the race kind of all funnel and lined up so that next weekend becomes something that you just have to watch, something that you just have to pay attention. This is the one race in Europe that you're really, really, finding difficult to trying to sort out who's going to win it. If you can focus on Ligue 1 if you want to, but if you won the real race, it's right here in La Liga, and it has to do with the fact that Fidel Chavez for Elche misses a penalty, hits it off the post. Imagine if that had gone in. How does that change Atletico Madrid? Today, Lionel Messi misses a penalty but gets bailed out in the end, and Barcelona somehow hang on. Look at what Real Madrid, their second goal, Casemiro, and excuse me, finish. Didn't really even mean to finish it that way. And guess what? They won the game. Somehow, all three of these teams won the game, and now Sevilla, tomorrow, have to come up with a performance if they're going to keep up.
Ali Moreno on your anti-French ways, thank you very much. Just a reminder then, as Ali rightly says at the Sanchez-Pizjuan on Monday, Sevilla against Athletic Bilbao, Sevilla favourites to take all 3 points in that tie.
Did you know less than 10% of Americans own an e-bike? Here's why that should change. Studies show e-bike owners actually end up exercising more, plus getting outside more. If you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and everyday adventures, you need to check out Lectric e-bikes. They are the number one selling e-bike brand in America. Their bikes are typically foldable, pre-assembled, and have serious range up to 150 miles on some models. Check them out today at lectricebikes.com and add some more adventure to your week. That's lectricebikes.com.
A 1-1 draw between Atalanta and Sassuolo was enough to confirm Inter Milan as the Serie A champions. They, of course, snapped that Juventus streak of 9 straight titles. It's the first time they won the Scudetto since 2010. Romelu Lukaku looked like a one-man celebration.
There's nobody in the streets.
For reaction on Inter's victory, welcoming Gab Marcotti, Matteo Bonetti. But it feels apt that we start with the former Inter Milan striker, Jurgen Klinsmann.
Yeah, this is awesome. I mean, this is just a lot of fun to see. Obviously, the people in Milano and all the Inter fans around the world, they were waiting for this more than 10 years now. Yep. More than 10 years we were waiting for that moment to win the championship again, the Scudetto in Italy. And it's a big day. It's a big day for the team, for the club, for Antonio Conte. And you really, really just have to tell them a huge congratulations. Tremendous season played in the Serie A. And and enjoy the moment. Really enjoy the moment. Get out there and have some fun.
Yeah, Matteo, thoroughly deserved.
Yeah, absolutely. Really taking advantage of Juventus and the way that they've slipped up this season under Andrea Pirlo. But what's more deserved is the way that Inter have evolved over the course of the season. It feels like we've all forgotten that they finished in fourth place in the Champions League group stage. That was basically a completely different team, right? That team was shrouded with negativity and people going at Conte, and the team doesn't play beautiful football, and they couldn't even defend at one point. But Conte turned that all around after the January transfer window. They kept Christian Eriksen, who became a big part the team in the second half of the season. Even Perisic, who was let go to Bayern and only won a treble there, came back and started playing really well left wing back, even though Conte said 2 years ago he wouldn't fit in his system. So Conte took players that initially thought wouldn't fit in his system. I mean, he made them key parts of this team that has defended so much better, that has played so much better, and that has been one of the most devastating that we've seen on the counter since maybe Jose Mourinho's Real Madrid side. So it's fully deserved and a huge achievement, given that they weren't even really the ones challenging Juve in the last 9 seasons. It was other teams like Napoli and Roma, but never really the two teams from Milan.
The ultimate revenge for Conte, Gab.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not sure he sees it that way. And, you know, it was funny because afterwards they came out and said, oh, look, you know, in winning this title, Conte has shed himself of his sort of inner Juventus heart. And I'm not sure it works that way. I think if you peel away the layers, I think he's still all black and white inside. But I think why this is important is Conte showed, you know what, I can win in Italy, and I can win not just with Juve, I can win with a different team. And I think, you know, Conte is fully committed to doing his job at whatever club employs him. Now, part of that commitment, and we already kind of saw a little bit come out here, but we saw it before at Chelsea, we certainly saw it at Juventus, is part of that commitment to winning is, I don't care about the finances. You get me what I need. You get me what I, you know, when I need it. And the rest is up to me. And so, you know, while I completely agree with Matteo that the way he turned Christian Eriksen around, I thought Ashraf Hakimi went to a next level, the way he got contribution of Perisic, the way he made Lukaku into a much better player, that is a credit to him. I think already you're seeing Conte, when he's talking about next season, you know, saying, well, let's wait and see where we are in terms of a new contract and whatever. And again, I think this is a guy who just wants to win and who sees it as sort of a constant battle to get the resources, to get the assets that he thinks he needs to win. And I'll tell you what, when he has those assets, he usually does win.
How much credit should he get for this victory, Jürgen?
Oh, Antonio should get a lot of credit for this win, especially with all those things that he went through. The big, obviously, disappointment was when they exited the Champions League and everybody was shocked. You know, all the Inter fans around the world, they were shocked. How can we kind of exit so early from the Champions League? So then there were obviously the problems with the Chinese ownership. You know, so the salaries were not paid to the players for a couple of months. You know, so there were turmoil everywhere. Then they exited also the Coppa Italia, so they were out of the cup. So the only thing that was remaining was the Scudetto, was the championship. But you got to give him so much credit because he was able then to have everybody zoom in and focus on what really matters now. He kind of got the team behind him, one player at a time, and pulled everything out of them that he could. And I mean, winning the title now with four games remaining to play is exceptional. It's exceptional. And that's why he really deserves a huge, huge, huge compliment from everyone. And hopefully he enjoys that moment.
Who was the star on the pitch for them, Matteo?
Romelu Lukaku. He's the one that Conte wanted all along. He wanted him at his time with Chelsea in the Premier League. He finally got him. I mean, this team has really bent over to get everything that Conte wanted in the transfer market. From when he got there, Romelu Lukaku cost a ton from the Nerazzurri to bring him over from the Premier League. But he's been so incredible on the counterattack. He has a first touch that everyone seemed to think he didn't have. He's been able to link up and hold up the play and allow players like Lautaro to get in behind or Ashraf Hakimi, but it has been really a team effort, I'd say spearheaded by the front two. The understanding that Lautaro and Lukaku have together, high IQ, understand each other's movements. Ashraf Hakimi out wide, who's one of the most dynamic wingbacks in the world. And then a very sturdy back line led by Steven De Vrij. It's been a team effort. Nicolo Barella, young midfielder who does everything, who really embodies the ideal kind of player that Conte dreams of in the midfield, who works from start to finish. But I'd say Romelu Lukaku is the MVP without a shadow of a doubt.
Is this a one-off gap?
Well, look, I don't want to get into a boring discussion about finances and money and the ownership. I mean, the reality is Milan's owners have had to sell a chunk of their company to the Chinese government to kind of make ends meet, whether they were asked or invited to do it by the government or whatever is neither here nor there. But the reality is the message has been we're going to focus on our core business. We're going to look for other people to come in. What this means in terms of whether they're going to continue investing. I think they have to cut costs anyway. I hope it turns into Conte saying, you know what, even if we got to cut some costs, you know, I don't need a 40-man squad. I don't need five Alexis Sanchez's and Arturo Vidal's and Kolarov's. Because let's not forget, this is the flip side of having Conte, right? It's that belief that, oh, I need all these old veteran guys because they're winners. Well, in the grand scheme of things, they contributed relatively little. And some of the people who really made the difference for Inter this year were people like Bastoni, like Perisic, who we turned around, like Barella, who we mentioned. And if he says, you know, less is more, let me trust some of the kids, let me live with it, I don't see why they can't go back and win another season. What I will say, though, is if they go back, especially if they do something in Europe, it's not going to be the Inter we saw the last 2-3 months. That was Inter playing a certain way on the counterattack, safety first, just to bring the title home. We're going to have to see the Inter that we saw only in part in the first part of the season, which is the Inter I think Conte wants us to see, which is the Inter that goes and takes the game to the opposition. I still think that is the only way you're going to win and make your mark in Europe. I think Conte believes that too. And I think if he stays, we'll see it. We'll see him have a go at it next year.
What do you think, Jürgen?
No, I think Gab is right. I mean, that two different things to discuss is definitely how you approach a campaign in the Champions League, you know, with all these big teams that are still in, you know, that are final eight. If you look at them, you need to play a different type of football. And Antonio knows that. He knows that he has to come out more. He has to be far more proactive. He has to kind of dictate the game far more. He won now the championship in a way that he was reacting cleverly to the opponent and on a counter break. He killed them. And that worked in the Italian championship, but it won't work in Europe. But Antonio knows that. He knows that. So it will be interesting to see if Inter is capable maybe to add 2 or 3 pieces to their roster in the summer break. But it is, it's fantastic. And just to see how he handled certain individuals throughout the entire season, how he turned around Christian Eriksen, made him real part of that team. I think his distribution the last 2-3 months was exceptional. Then the two youngsters, obviously we mentioned it, Bastoni and Barella. Those are real shining stars already for the Italian national team. So we will see then in this summer's European Championship if they can put already their stamp on the Italian national team. And then, as we said, Lukaku and Martinez, it's a striking partnership that is just exceptional. I mean, that partnership would work in any club in Europe. So therefore, Antonio knows it. There are two different, you know, stories to it. One is the Italian championship, one is the European campaign. So it will be really, really fascinating to see how he comes out next season.
Meanwhile, the race for the top four, good day for Lazio. Still very much there or thereabouts after a 4-3 victory over Genoa. Meanwhile, a frustrating day for Napoli. They were 1-0 up against Cagliari going into the 94th minute, conceding a late goal and dropping 2 points. Speaking of late drama, goodness me, Juventus 1-0 down against Udinese until the 82nd minute. But 2 goals from Cristiano Ronaldo would see Juve move up to 3rd in the table. Jürgen, we've got to start with Cristiano Ronaldo.
Well, obviously, but he is just simply he's a winner. He's never has enough. I mean, he continuously, you know, finds ways to improve his game, to be there when he's needed. I mean, obviously, a lot has been said about this Juventus campaign this year because we often talked about maybe the word transition under Pirlo, but he's just delivering when it's needed and as much as he can. I mean, he cannot do everything himself. I admire him, you know, every time, and he keeps them in the race now for the Champions League spots. It's going to be very, very tight, that race, as we obviously saw just now on the table of the league. But in my opinion, you know, certainly there are things that we can discuss about Juventus that didn't go well the entire year, if it's in Europe or if it's in the Serie A, but certainly not Cristiano Ronaldo.
Was Pirlo getting sacked in the 81st minute, Matteo?
I mean, if they lost this game, Dan, and honestly, there was no sense of urgency. Forget the scoreline for a minute, even though that is important because Cristiano Ronaldo might have just given the Champions League for another year to Juventus. But before that, it was one of the poorest Juventus performances. And this is something that we've seen throughout the season, Dan, where you have no idea what version of Juve you're going to get from 1 week to another. 1 week, you think, right, Pirlo's starting to put it together. This thesis that everyone was fawning over last summer, we're starting to see this beautiful game. And then 2 weeks after, they're losing against relegation-threatened side. There's no identity whatsoever. We still have no idea what the best Juve starting 11 is, and we're near the end of the season. But this would be one of the most calamitous finishes in, I think, Serie A in the modern history. If Juventus were to finish outside the top four, next weekend's Milan versus Juve will tell us everything. But I don't see how he would have been kept on past this summer if they lost today. Maybe not tomorrow, but this summer it's time for this revolution and the rebuilding that Gab's been talking about. we've been seeing it, because bringing in Pirlo was technically a rebuild, and right now no one really has any idea what this team is, whereas the last nine seasons you had a semblance of an identity where you knew, right, they can hold on to a 1-0 lead. This season, no defensive solidity, sloppy, mistakes that are elementary, and this has been the pattern both in the Champions League and Serie A.
Gap?
I agree. I don't think Pirlo would have been sacked if he lost this game, because they do have the big head-to-head coming up. But I think it's pretty clear. But I think you said as much that, you know, we're not contemplating finishing outside of the top four. I think it's been very disappointing, the lack of progress this season. I'll say it again. What do you want me to say? They're going in the right direction in terms of realizing that they need to make a change, and you cannot continue with this defend and counter and sit deep and wait for your old guys to do something, right? That's out the window. Maybe Pirlo's not the guy to bring it. And that's what they're going to have to decide. But I still think they're going in that direction. But I think the major impact is going to be, again, if they finish outside of the top four, they take a massive financial hit on top of the ones that they've already taken because of COVID. And then you really have some big decisions to make. You know, the old thing, oh, that's fine, we'll just sell Dybala. Well, you know what? Nobody's going to take him now. Not at the money you want to sell him at. What do you do with Morata? He's only on loan. Can you afford to keep him? Can you keep making your payments on Federico Chiesa? What do you do with Cristiano, who's got a year left? Do you keep him on for another season? Does he want to stay another season? There aren't that many saleable assets on this team. So I think tough choices would have to be made. And that's why the stakes are so high for Juve. It's not just, you know, get Pirlo out, put somebody else in there, he'll do a better job. It's not that simple. Chickens are coming home to roost for, I think, mistakes that were made in previous years. And since you don't want me to name names, I'll mention Adrian Rabiot, Aaron Ramsey, two above everybody else, two guys who make an enormous amount of money and I don't think have any business being there. And on top of that, are going to be really, really difficult to sell.
Name more names, Gab. I like it when you name names.
You want to get me started?
Matteo, do you agree with what Gab's saying?
Yeah, absolutely. These free transfers that they've been pulling off, it's like, okay, you're not spending the money on the actual transfer, but the agent's getting a massive fee. The salaries for Adrian Rabiot and Aaron Ramsey, the two names that Gab mentioned, they're making world-class player money for rotational pieces that should have no part in starting for a team that has the ambitions that Juventus have. But you can go across the board. Even, you know, when they were playing Kulusevski and Chiesa, like, okay, these are young players, but you're playing one as a wing-back, the other one's out of position, you have Bernardeschi at left-back. Like, there's so much chaos in this Juventus side. They have a few young pieces, but they really messed up on a lot of these transfers in the last few seasons, especially in the midfield, where they said, right, we are going to invest in bringing over the players like, you know, you think of Vidal, Marchisio, Pirlo, Pogba, when they had those four players. None of these guys would have gotten a minute on that team in the mid-2000s where Andrea Pirlo was actually a manager. And it's not like you're going to be able to get rid of some of these guys. There's no one. It's going to be like Christian Eriksen in January. No one wanted to take that 7.5 million euro salary a year on midway through the season with COVID and the financial crisis that there's been. No one's going to take half the players that Juventus are paying way too much for that aren't contributing.
Let's take a look at the running. As you mentioned, obviously, Juventus against Milan, a huge match next weekend. On the Serie A Awesome podcast, Matteo, just a couple of weeks ago, I heard you say that you didn't think Milan were going to make top four. Was that a double bluff with your Milan ways?
No, I still don't. And that's because Milan have the toughest schedule remaining out of any teams. All the games they're playing from now until the end of the season are either against teams that are fighting to be in the Champions League or teams that are fighting for their lives. There's no mid-table teams that maybe have started mailing it in since a few weeks ago. And this Juventus game, if there's anything to go by, you look at the one from a few months ago where Federico Chiesa played the game of his life. I don't think Milan fans are feeling that confident, and Milan have been in a bit of a rut themselves in 2021. So I'm still sticking by at that Milan finish outside the top four. And what a disappointment that would be, the first time in Serie A history that a team that leads the league for more than half the season finishes outside the top four.
What do you think, Gab? Double bluff?
Oh, it's a total double bluff. But I'll tell you what, that game between Milan and Juve, the stakes are so high in another sense as well. Gigio Donnarumma, who I think is a player who Milan have to keep pretty much at all costs, figuratively speaking. He's becomes a free agent in the summer. His agent, of course, is Mino Raiola. He's got a contract sitting in front of him. He hasn't signed it yet. On Saturday morning, he was visited at the training ground by a group of Milan fans who basically put pressure on him and said, listen, you don't want to sign the contract, don't sign the contract. But if you don't sign the contract, give us the respect not to play against Juventus. Or in other words, say, look, I'm not going to play because this is the team I could be joining next season. It would be an enormous conflict of interest. And, you know, this is another kind of heavy weight to put on the minds of a young man who is just 21, 22 years old, however old he is. I find it an extraordinary subtext.
Yeah.
And if I was a club, I would just go to him and say, look, Gigio, don't worry about Juve. You just go ahead and beat them. They won't be able to afford you anyway. If you go and beat them, and then you can come back and you stay with us. But it is remarkable, and it's kind of a reminder of who wields so much power in this sport right now, and it's not always the clubs.
How's this going to play out, Matteo?
So Mino Raiola has already done a lot of damage to Gianluigi Donnarumma. Think back a few years ago when he wanted that contract renewal that would have paid him very handsomely for a then teenager. That was the worst form that Donnarumma had in his Milan career. It even got to the point where fans started throwing money on him when he was in goal, saying that that's all he cared about. And that was because of the agent. And it's almost ironic that all the times that you hear talk about renegotiations and a contract renewal, that's when Donnarumma starts having his worst performances. So clearly this is affecting him, unless it's just some strange coincidence that the two times that Mino Raiola and Donnarumma's money has come out in the media is when Donnarumma has a stretch of poor games. But you know, to doubt the professionalism that he would somehow throw the game is ridiculous from the Milan ultras, who, by the way, tend to be very emotional, as Gab would know.
Jürgen, as a coach, how on earth do you handle this situation?
Well, you're just going straightforward to the player. You have a talk with him, you know, and spend some time with him and pick his brain, you know. And then you tell him a couple of examples from your own kind of career. There was maybe similar moments when you maybe, you know, were on the way to leave a club and join a new club, you know, when you had to make big decisions. And so you try to kind of be close to the player. Obviously, you don't want to enter too deep into the whole topic because it's a very difficult situation nowadays for coaches and people when players listen too much to their agents. The power of agents nowadays is unheard. It's huge. It's huge. There are certain agents out there. They even, you know, control the transfer market of certain clubs. You know, and this is how it went over the last 10, 15 years, more and more that direction. So it's a very, very difficult subject, especially for a young professional that doesn't understand this entire world, you know, where the money, how the money flows, who's getting paid at the end of the day and all these things. So it's normal that Donnarumma in that moment, you know, has his head full and is maybe a little bit insecure, but he will get more mature with every day he plays and every game he plays. And hopefully he makes wise decisions at the end of the day.
How would you have dealt with this, Shane?
Dan, I just on that, I should point out that Paolo Maldini, speaking for the club, is the way he's handled it is they said, all right, we're not doing any contract extensions now until the end of the season. We're freezing every contract negotiation. It's not clear if that includes Zlatan's contract, which they had agreed it, but you know whether that's actually formally gone through or not. But anyway, he's saying we're just taking this off the table until the summer. And we'll deal with it then. But it's clearly not a good way to approach such a huge game for Donnarumma.
Listen, as a player, these are situations that you want to be played in big games. And I don't think the fact that your contract is running out, and even if Juventus is one of the most likely clubs to land you if you do go on a free transfer, that's not your concern right now.
But about the fans? What about the fans coming to you and saying, look, well, right inside, don't bother?
But again, Donnarumma's had to deal with this a few years ago, as Matteo pointed out. And I think he was even less prepared, certainly as a teenager, emotionally, to deal with that circumstance. I think he learned from it, would have grown from it. And this, for me, pales in comparison, in all honesty. It's not ideal.
Right.
You'd prefer it never happened. You don't want to have to deal with that. You don't want that on the back of your mind. But given what you had to deal with a couple of years ago as a teenager, I think you're more than emotionally prepared or capable of dealing with this. And you go out and you play your game. And then whatever happens, come the summer, as Guy points out, Milan not doing new contracts. If Milan are finished top four and Juventus doesn't, that changes everything about your thinking. Similarly, those roles reversed.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden, it's totally different. That's not your concern right now. Your concern is going out onto the field, playing the best game that you possibly can, and then letting those pieces fall where they may and figuring it out. And that's a great situation for anybody to be in, where it's a win-win. Your contract is up. You have two incredible clubs chasing your signature, and now all you have to do is go out and play. That's all any player ever asks for.
Let's just remind you then of those remaining fixtures, as I'll go to Gab Marcotti first and ask him who will be in the top four, Gab, come the end of the season.
Look, I think so much is going to hinge on the head-to-heads. I think Milan are going to do it. So I'm going to say, and I'll be boring and say Milan, Atalanta, and Juve. I think Juve can afford one loss, and I think Atalanta is going to sneak in there. But I think it's going to be super tight between Atalanta and Napoli.
Matteo?
I'm going to go with Juventus, Atalanta, and Napoli. Milan finishing the Europa League, and we'll play Bate Borisov in August.
Oh, wow.
Why are you picking on poor old Bate Borisov?
Poor old Bate Borisov. Jürgen?
Well, as obviously an Interista, I hope it's Atalanta, Juve, Napoli.
And then Bate Borisov will win in August. Jack?
Yeah, I think sadly Milan.
No love for Lazio. Good win today.
No love for Lazio. Just a little bit too much ground to make up. I think ultimately Juventus' resolve gets them into the top four, even if their football doesn't seem to deserve it. And then Milan, and three of their last four on the road, I think will prove too huge a test for them.
Meanwhile, a huge game at the bottom of the table on Monday. Torino taking on Parma, a game you can see live on ESPN+.
Passion, drive and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights and more. Whether you're into speed, power or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
In France, it is quite the title race, isn't it, between Lille and PSG. But what a game it was today between Lyon and Monaco. Lyon winning late by 3-2. Jules still with us. Jules, what a game this was.
Incredible. And again, remember last Sunday we had the wonderful Lyon-Lille game, and now it's this Monaco-Lyon game. And Ligue 1 again, I mean, being an incredible season and an incredible end of the season, this title race. Now the race for first and second between Lille and PSG will go down to the wire. Now the race for third and fourth between Monaco and Lyon will go down to the wire, because Lyon tonight, had they lost that game and it looked for a while that they were going to lose it, would have even finished all their hopes to qualify and finishing third and qualifying for the Champions League of next season, which is very important for them. Now they're still in it. They can fight with Monaco for this that third place, the last place in the Champions League, and let PSG and Lille fight it off for the title. But one incredible game again, and another great publicity for Ligue 1, apart from the fight at the end, although we've had a few fights in Ligue 1 this season as well.
Who doesn't like a bit of a fight? It's all right. We can't pretend that we don't like a fight, Jules. Well, I think we're okay. Overall, title race, who's going to win it?
Well, we've got a huge derby, North Derby, next weekend between Lens and Lille. And we've said since the beginning that Lens will be the referee of this title race because they played PSG this weekend. They lost narrowly at the Parc des Princes. Now they can take some points away from Lille and maybe advantage PSG. But they also will play Monaco in the following game week. So now that Monaco are of the title race, really, it's a lot down to what Lens, who are fifth in the table right now, what they can do in that big derby. They were humiliated in the reverse fixture in Lille earlier in the season when they lost 4-0 that derby, and surely they will want their revenge. They will also want to cement their fifth place and qualify for the Europa League for next season. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot at stake, and for Lille as well. But if Lille can beat Lens, then I think they will be champions.
Meanwhile, of course, a big match this weekend, this midweek, sorry, in the Champions League. You've got Manchester City taking on PSG. City going to that tie 2-1 up. Jules Nayden with us. Jules, let's talk about Kylian Mbappe. Yesterday, I asked you, so you said, no, it'd be fine for this game, don't worry. Didn't train today, though.
Didn't train, which apparently was part of the recovery process that PSG had for him and all the treatment that he's been doing for the last 3-4 days, really. They're still very optimistic that he will be there, even if he's not fully fit, fully 100%. And I think they know that even you can't do it without Kylian Mbappe there. And even a Kylian Mbappe with 50%, 80% can help you qualify if you get that chance. So I think they will do everything they can for him to be there, even if he's just 80% of his physical ability, really. But I guess the next 2 days will be key. But from what I believe and what I was told, today was not a surprise that he was not training, really. Tomorrow will be the big day if he's there training before the game, the day before the game.
It wasn't his best performance in the first leg, Jules. Was he injured then?
So he says he was not fully fit, exactly. And we've seen a few moments in the game where he was stretching his groin, his calf as well, which is where the problem was this weekend. And that's why he didn't play on Saturday against Lens and why he didn't train today either. He's played a lot of games. He's had a lot of little niggles, and he had COVID, of course, back in August, which hit him quite hard. So there's a big question mark over how much has he really been fit this season overall. But certainly it looked like he was not 100% in that first leg, and maybe that can explain partly why he was so disappointing. But he won't be fit regardless in the second leg on Tuesday. He won't be 100% again. So let's see what he can do again, where he's quite diminished for such a big game.
Nadim, you're Mr. Sensible on the show. You'll tell me it's a big tesser. Manchester City, PSG have got some big players. City inexperienced at this level of the game. So will they be lucky to maybe even make it through to the final?
Do you want me to say anything, or are you just going to do my whole bit?
Well, I don't know. This is what I expect from you when we talk about Manchester City. You play down their chances as if they're just a little underdog.
No. Listen, I don't play them down. I don't play down their chances. I understand why they're favourites. I think the odds which were up before seem very, you know, I don't necessarily agree with those. But to be seeing that Mbappe is not 100% fit, to see that, say, PSG have lost their game midfield, to know that they've scored those two goals away from home, yes, they are the favourites, but they still need to execute in the game. And I think for PSG, they can score two goals, but I am confident in City because I believe they can win this one particular match itself, even if PSG score two. So, this news about Mbappe, if it ends up that he's not 100% fit, then great, timing is everything for City. And it'll be a huge, huge boost if he's not 100% fit, or even if he's not playing. But I think ultimately it's going to be a very, very good game. But I think City are right to be favourites in this instance because, as I say, they hold the lead and they hold the momentum.
Will they be okay keeping up that rhythm, that momentum after that second half performance, Nadim, considering that hardly any of them played at the weekend, given all the changes that Guardiola made?
Well, you see, something about, I think, football this year is that you could miss a game, but then the rate in which you're playing matches then is the same as what it has been for probably every other sort of season in your career. To go a week without playing a game was perfectly normal once upon a time, but now you miss a midweek game and someone says, oh, you know, you're out of rhythm and so on and so forth. But I think for whatever team he puts out for that game on Tuesday, I think it's going to be the best possible setup and combination of players for it. Some might have played on the weekend, some might not have. But the fact is, it's a game against PSG where you have a great opportunity to make it to a Champions League final. And I think the excitement and, you know, the fact that they do have a lead and so on, I think it could potentially bring out some great performances in those players. And even though some of them might not have played on the weekend, you know, you're looking forward to the next game, and the next game is a Champions League semi-final at home, and what a great opportunity it is, and it's probably the biggest game for the club in probably the last 30, 40 years, so I think it should be a great occasion.
It's going to be brilliant, isn't it? Well, not if you're Jules, obviously. Thank you very much, Jules. Just a reminder, 24 hours later, it is Chelsea against Real Madrid. 1-1 it stands going into the second leg at Stamford Bridge. Meanwhile, in the Premier League today, as of course we mentioned at the top of the show, no game between Manchester United and Liverpool. Meanwhile, Spurs thrashing Sheffield United, I think it was 4-0 in the end. Gareth Bale with a hat-trick in that match to put them very much back in the hunt for a top four, 5 points adrift, 4 games to play. It's a big ask, isn't it, Nader, if they're going to catch Chelsea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for the way Chelsea have been playing, you can't really see them dropping that many points between now and the end of the season. I think Chelsea may have a tough game next week against Man City, but you know, ultimately for Spurs, it seems like it's probably a little bit too late. And it's a shame because you see them playing the way they did today, and obviously it was against a side who are bottom of the Premier League, but I think last week in the League Cup final, they had 2 shots on goal, and that was such a disappointment because they do have this type of attacking threat. These players look very, very confident here, but you know, in that game that really felt like it was their whole season last week, you know, they just didn't show up. But ultimately, you know, for Spurs, they're going to keep pushing, hope things do go their way. And who knows, maybe it's possible, but then we shouldn't also forget the fact that, say, Liverpool right behind them have a game in hand. Mm. Obviously, it's against Manchester United, but it's more than just one team who's trying to catch up to Chelsea in fourth. So it should be a very interesting last few weeks of the season.
Why didn't Gareth Bale do this more this season, Nadim? Was it a case at Sheffield United?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, you know, obviously, I speak to him all the time, so sometimes, you know, he sometimes says to me, it's a bit of this.
Well, I don't know. No, I thought as a professional player, sure. As someone who's played the game, maybe you can relate to the fact that listen, he has not put in these sort of performances enough.
The difference between you talking to me about professional football is the same as me as an ex-professional talking about Gareth Bale, who's been one of the best in the world. I've not been there, you've not been there, so let's just speculate. I heard apparently at the start of the season, he wasn't 100% fit and he had issues with certain things. So he never really hit the ground running, couldn't really get into a rhythm. Then he got into the side and then the team wasn't performing well. He wasn't performing well and it was a shame for him. But at that same time, you were seeing Kane and Son. They were forging that partnership, that relationship, which was great. And for Bale, as I say, he never really seemed to be that important a player for Spurs this season, which seems crazy considering, you know, he's essentially just there for the season. But every so often he shows glimpses. But I think the biggest disappointment for him this season, as that's probably been the case for the last couple of years, is that it is in glimpses. He can do something which is so, so spectacular. But for the way Spurs were playing and so on, it just wasn't, just didn't seem to be consistent enough in both directions, in attack and in defence. And so other people have played ahead of him. And now it's really strange because it doesn't even feel, it feels more weird to see him starting than it does to see him on the bench. And that's a crazy spot to be in because the last time he was at Spurs, he was probably the most important player, you could argue, apart from Jurgen, obviously, in their Premier League history. So it's crazy to see.
He just texted me and said, you're talking nonsense. Apparently, Nadim. Meanwhile, let's talk about the red card, shall we, Jack? The one that wasn't given. Ryan Mason furious at the fact that Sheffield United knocked down to 10 men.
Yeah, I think that this is a foul for me. John Fleck, I think, goes to catch Lo Celso on the shoulder and then his boot slips off his shoulder into his face. The stamp on the shoulder for me is intentional. And so therefore, what comes after just adds to it. The stamp on the shoulder is enough to warrant a red, in my opinion. The fact that it then slips off the shoulder into the face makes it, you know, it just rubs salt into the wound. Yeah. And Ryan Mason, absolutely right to be furious that Fleck does not see red for this.
Does Fleck mean it, Nadim?
I don't know if I agree with Shaq. I don't know if he means to go into his face, but I think he's left a bit on him there on purpose, because ultimately, as a player, you've been in times before where, say, there's a tangle of bodies and so on, and you go over the top in an effort to not land on somebody. And I think he could have done that looking at the way that he was moving at that time. So I think he's tried to maybe leave a little bit on him, but the circumstances have led to him going onto someone's face. And I agree, it should 100% have been a red card. And the only way I can think that it wasn't is if maybe the referee said to the VAR that, you know, he'd seen it and he had a clear view of it. And so as a consequence, I guess they couldn't overrule him. But to look at that video and to not have, you know, that other bit of context around it, like it just seems obvious. And worse still for me, I was always the type of person where I knew if I did something wrong and did it by accident, I'd apologize. But Fleck afterwards, he's just holding his hand up saying, like, what's going on? He's looking at Lo Celso like Lo Celso's done something wrong. But that's a horrendous, for me, that's horrendous. And I think looking back, he's been so, so lucky to escape that. And I think looking at the VAR system, it's stuff like this which shouldn't be happening, because someone could have been seriously hurt there and have missed a huge call. It's something, you know, Fleck ultimately didn't deserve to be on the field after that challenge.
Shaq, I'm not sure if you saw this. I'm glad you're here to talk about what happened yesterday in the match against Chelsea. Take a look here. He keeps undoing the goalkeeper's glove. Bobby Reid.
Let me tell you something. Outfield players are right. Oh, goodness. Outfield players are so annoying. Why are you going to do that?
Anyone ever do that to you?
No. No. Poor old Mandy thinking, oh, goodness.
Nathan, would you ever have done this?
Craig would do.
You know what it is? It's not even outfielders, Shaka. It's attackers. Attackers are the weirdest bunch of people going. They do stuff like this because they know ultimately you can't go and cry to the referee, ref, he's playing with my glove, The referee's like, all right, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, they can do that type of stuff and it gets under your skin, but they just get away with it. It doesn't really serve much purpose overall, but, you know, they're having a great time, but it tends to be at your expense. The amount of times they'll pull your shirt or they'll pull your arm, give you a little nip here or something like that, and ultimately it's why sometimes you just need to put a really big challenge on them just to calm them down just a little bit.
How do you come up with that? Well, you know, I'm used to, you know, a player would come and stand on your heel or something of the sort and kind of play it off. But you know, you're at home and you think, you know what I'm going to do tomorrow?
Yep.
When we get a set piece, I'm going to undo the keeper's gloves. You know how annoying you just have to be all by yourself?
And he keeps coming back for more.
How annoying is that? Oh, goodness.
Is that foul?
I don't know. That's a good question. Referee has a clear look at it. He's got a great view.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, that's it. Nathan, thank you very much. Premier League action continues on Monday. Shaka's former side, West Ham, in action. Trying to turn things around a little bit.
What? No, I've turned things around. We're 2021, 2022 European champions.
Yep. 11-8, West Ham, to get the win. Just didn't tell us which European competition.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
No surprise, the story that dominates the newspapers in the UK, mutiny, rioting fans storm Old Trafford. This was not only on the back pages, but the front pages as well of the newspapers in England. Very much the dominant story. Day United's anger at owners turned ugly. Anarchy at Old Trafford. Still a lot more details, of course, to come. Exactly what happened and what repercussions we will see after fans went on the pitch at Old Trafford, which saw the delay of that game, well, the postponement of that game between Manchester United and Liverpool. That's it. Thank you very much to Shaka. Thank you very much to everybody else who has been on. We'll be back tomorrow for more. Until then, goodbye.